Yeah, something like that.
Well, good morning. So thank you again for the invitation to speak today about a topic which I've titled an alternative management strategy for manure impacted environments. And I don't know that there's a clicker up here necessarily. Where is that? Oh, right here. Okay. So,
does your thing work for? I think that's just
That works.
But you can use that for a.
So, first I'd just like to say I appreciated the previous talks that gave a real nice shout out for the value of structure and function and understanding that in arthropods. It really speaks to my heart. But I'd also like to point out that biodiversity matters. Biodiversity in agriculture matters. And there's been some new kind of reframing of some of these thoughts about the interactions between agricultural landscapes and the associated environment. And so I put together this cartoon here to sort of describe from a 50,000 foot view some of the thoughts that some workers have considered in trying to connect both a very purposeful planned biodiversity setup in an agricultural environment that takes the best advantage of the associated biodiversity of the environment. So in other words, thinking about agroecosystem management from the outset as an agricultural production process to take best advantage of the biodiversity of the surrounding environment. And the reason biodiversity matters is because while we have a great deal of heritability, of that heritable variation of organisms in the environment, most of which are made up of arthropods, a very small portion of those arthropods are pests, and some larger portion are beneficial, and relative to agriculture, some are inconsequential. So again, biodiversity as a concept really wasn't even defined until 1986 when there was an international conference that defined it, believe it or not. But you know, none of these thoughts are really all that old. There are some challenges in managing these environments in such a way. One being obvious that not all systems are alike. And there's some pretty obvious ways in which they differ: age, structure, management, and whatnot. But Southwood and Way actually defined ecosystem diversity back in 1970, again before we had a working definition for biodiversity. And they defined these four characteristics, at least relative to cropping systems, that can define those qualities of a cropping system or a cropping environment or agri-ecosystem, if you will. So increased diversity of vegetation of the entire landscape improves biodiversity, or ecosystem diversity in this case. The increase of a permanence of the crop improves ecosystem diversity. Low management intensity. As you lower your management intensity, you improve these biodiversity or ecosystem diversity factors. And having a low isolation between the cropping system itself and natural vegetation improves the relationship in that ecosystem diversity. So I thought this was interesting as I kind of walked my way through this process and looking at some of these ecosystem diversity characteristics that have been defined long ago, even though currently we're kind of thinking this is something new. So there's really very few things that are actually new, and hopefully we all are standing on the shoulders of giants as we work forward. Now my interest as part of this talk, and really as somebody who's worked a lot in cropping systems and row crops, it's sort of a new venture for me, kind of fun at the same time. And so what I've provided here is a model that's used in rangeland grasshopper management that some of you might be familiar with. And to me, this represents a couple things. One is there's the full process here at play of IPM in using both pest management strategies that are commonly recognized in integrated pest management or parts of integrated pest management. On the left-hand side, again, using rangeland grasshopper management here as an example, the left-hand side are what are referred to preventative strategies for pest management. And these are things that you set up in the environment. Many times they're cultural, they're cheaper options, but it really it speaks back to what I mentioned earlier about preparing the environment or setting up the environment for best case scenario. And in the case for rangeland grasshopper management, you can see here that there's efforts to manage for plant vigor. In doing so, you increase herbage and ground cover, and this provides some benefits for grasshoppers that benefits for grasshopper management that I won't go into today. And then that's all wrapped up in a rotational grazing system. And in grazing management, a lot of times they call these best practices. And so this isn't to ignore the fact that we still have severe outbreaks of grasshoppers in the environment. Outbreaks happen. I mean, that could be on anyone's bumper sticker that's entomologist that works on rangeland in a lot of western systems for that matter. And so that's why we have the curative or therapeutic pest management practices as well. So it's not ignoring that those ecosystem cycles still are at play, but even within those therapeutic processes on the right, you can see intervention where it's really more targeted, site-targeted application processes. And then part of why I'm bringing this up and spending time on this, if you look down at the suppression aspect of therapeutic practices, the RAAT, the RATS program, Reduced Agent Area Treatment, is a widely adopted management practice for managing outbreaks of grasshoppers in rangeland systems. And what that does is treats part of the land, it reduces the number of active ingredients by half in some cases required to control, and it's reducing the number of acres in sort of alternating strips across the landscape of treated land, untreated land. And part of that is to then conserve in those untreated strips those beneficial organisms that can naturally regulate those grasshopper populations. So it's a compromise, right? So it's recognizing that you've taken the effort to make these preventative strategies work. Outbreaks still happen. You have to manage for them. But when you do so, you don't want to completely give yourself a clean slate and walk back on those preventative measures that you've taken. So that's sort of the framework that I'd want to walk through this talk with you today. And really, so this is the outline of the talk, trying to connect two outcomes of two separate projects at the University of Nebraska, one in which I'm involved with and which there's a current symposium going on, but stay here for this one. Looking at, in part, conserving dung beetles through grazing management. And so I'll be speaking very briefly about that today. And then Gary Brewer, who's in the back of the room, is leading some efforts looking at using biopesticides with minimal effects on dung beetles, presumably. Really, and that's targeting stable flies. So that's where the stable fly part of this talk comes in. So this is an interesting slide. So Losi and others have given this value assessment of dung beetles in the environment. So $380 million in services annually provided by dung beetles. Some people are smiling at me and thinking, no way. Well, presumably they do this through gas recycling, carbon sequestration, nitrogen fixation into the soil, and increasing porosity of the soil, which improves water take-up of the soil. And so that's what he's speaking to here in this $380 million figure here. And this is how. So dung beetles have what are referred to as three common niche practices that they engage as a group of dung beetles, being more than one family, but predominantly the Scarabaeidae. So those are dwellers that actually live within the dung path, and so as adults and larvae, many of which they develop their entire life cycle in the path, and in the process of doing that, I forgot to mention this earlier, they do lice fly eggs to some degree and provide some pest control services in that process. The tunneler dung beetles that generally take their brood balls that they make and partner with females and bury those down into the ground to some cases fairly significant depths depending on species, moving that ephemeral resource into the soil. And of course, maybe the more geographic, National Geographic famous ones are the rollers that take a portion of the manure resource and move it sometimes great distances away from that dung pad, again with their mate partners, and bury it into the soil. And so these are the processes in which, as you can see here, those ecosystems are services are provided by these insects. So there's been some popular statements made by some range scientists, you could say, Alan Savory being one of them, that had made some statements about the only way that we can save the Earth, basically, and limit greenhouse gas production is to move cattle bunched and to mimic nature as much as beef cattle can mimic nature. Move them bunched in herds throughout the landscape to help in part restore or maintain or increase dung beetle diversity in the landscape to try to really tap into some of these ecosystem services that they provide. And so Martha Mamo and myself and a number of others had a NIFA project funded to look at this question in part, because I've received part of my time is as an extension entomologist, and believe it or not, I have received quite a few calls about dung beetles from ranchers wanting to know where do I get those. Well, you might already have them in some unknown diversity in your existing landscape. Believe it or not, there are some companies, I think there's one in Florida that sells Digitanthophagus gazella, which is an African species of dung beetle. And so you can buy it on the internet and you can release them on your landscape even if you don't actually have them naturally, and might extirpate all those beetles that are already there working for you anyway. So don't really want that to happen, but part of this is in response to range managers wanting to know a little bit more about that. So from a broad perspective, for that to be true, for cattle bunched and moving to provide the best optimum for range management, we've got these two hypotheses that we've addressed with in our proposal, looking at either a spatially coupled nutrient cycling process, so where presuming that the cattle are feeding on one site and in relatively close proximity to where they're defecating or urinating. So basically what's coming off of the grazing, what's coming off the land is going back into the land more closely in proximity to each other. Whereas the other model of a more random roam of cattle across the landscape in a larger pasture, there may be a more spatially uncoupled nutrient cycling process where the forage is taking off are not necessarily, you know, more spatially separated from one another, where the depositions are making being made and the nitrogen's being cycled back through. So to do this, I've got a graduate student. He had a poster yesterday. I didn't know when I was putting this talk together at the time that the poster was going to be yesterday. I thought it was going to line up a little better with this talk. That's okay. So so Pat Wagner's been looking at this project where we've got six treatments listed here. So we're looking at up at Barton Brothers Ranch, which is in the eastern Sandhills region of Nebraska, a really beautiful place to work in. Looking at continuous grazing at less than 1 AU per hectare. We have a haying only treatment, so no cattle put out there. We have a mob or management intensive grazing system at 500 AU per acre. And then we have a once over and twice over rotational grazing system looking at 20 AU per acre. And no grazing and no haying, so just meadow. And in terms of diversity and functional groups, we've just started kind of really dig into the statistical analyses of these. But in terms of functional groups, we found all those kind of three broadly identified functional groups of dung beetles, a number of rollers, dwellers, and tunnelers. And actually, we've been able to contribute some paratypes to a current manuscript of a new Batanius species, which is kind of fun. For an agricultural project to contribute to as well. And if we look at dung beetle diversity and grazing over these three treatments, on the y-axis is the reciprocal of Simpson's diversity. So it's sort of a relative, just a fairly simple biodiversity index, so nothing fancy at this point. But that's what we have on the y-axis for both 2014 and 2015. And across the x we have our treatments, continuous, hay, mob, once over, twice over. So those three are all considered rotational grazing strategies in our control where we had no cattle. And what we can see is that for all three of those rotational grazing strategies, at least relevant to dung beetle diversity, those are all significantly higher from continuous grazing practices or the hay or control. But we found no significant difference in the end of year based on diversity between the mob grazing practice and the once over and twice over practice. So no difference between and that mob grazing practice, basically those are half an acre pasture paddocks where cattle are moved twice daily. So there's a lot of fencing involved. It's very very much more intensive than the once over and twice over grazing practices, with twice over being sort of the common practice in the eastern sandhills of Nebraska. So this was sort of encouraging results, actually, this year to some of our ranchers.
What's one over D
mean?
What's the vertical axis?
The y-axis is the reciprocal of Simpson's D, which is just a general biodiversity index. So this is sort of a first look. There's still a lot of work we have to do with these data. And you know, I didn't mention this earlier on this slide, which I should have. Our sampling methodology here was pitfall traps, and they were baited pitfall traps. And I have a local zoo that donates chimp manure to my program, which I'm very grateful to. We freeze up large amounts of chimp manure, and we bait these traps, these metal plates with holes in the ground to collect these dung beetles. Yeah, so we have other aspects of the study. We're looking at greenhouse gas emissions as well, and we're also trying to do some functional studies where we have dung pats that have cages that exclude dung beetles and some that are open, and looking at some of those influences that I won't be talking about today. Other than to say there was a study in Finland where they looked across the entire countryside where they had a setup with, as you can see here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, those treatments represent cages of different mesh sizes. So they put this out throughout the landscape and asked the question, what if we exclude, basically by size, different decomposers in the system? And what they found is as you increase the mesh size or exclude more decomposers, you have an impact on the dung pat mass, as you can see on the y-axis here, over time. And so the more decomposers you allow onto those pats, the more decomposition services you're providing. So that was sort of an assumption we had at the outset that you know, the methodologies we're using, again, that I won't be talking about today, to exclude some of those dung beetles, we should be able to measure that in the landscape. And so also with this, as we mentioned earlier, 2 minutes, all right, 2 minutes, Gary. Through these services, then we should be able to see some fly control. And so Gary Brewer, Dave Boxler, and Jerry Zhu have been looking at stable fly control using some novel methodologies. And you've all heard a lot about stable fly and stable fly life cycle already during previous talks, so I don't think I have to go into this too much. But they're focused on manure associated larval development sites, these large hail bale feeder locations. And issues, as were mentioned before, by stable flies is mainly a cattle issue, particularly in the case of this study, and trying to find a better way to target some of these sites for treatment. As was mentioned earlier, some of the issues with cattle grazing are reduced weight, as was shown by Jack Campbell some years back. And part of that is some of these grazing patterns that are affected by fly bites, essentially. And so currently we have mist blower systems that a lot of rangeland managers use with permethrin primarily, but there are some other oral ingestants that can be used for fly control as well that may have a larger impact on dung beetles, for example, some of the dimelins that can be used. So there's a need for more alternative control strategies, and some of which, you know, as mentioned earlier, stable flies aren't, I don't think resistance has been documented in them quite to the extent that house flies have been, but nonetheless, due to a limitation of the number of labeled insecticides and resistance issues, some novel strategies need to be pursued. So Gary and others looked at repeated measures designed within weeks, with 4 to 6 weeks per study per year. And they looked at stable flies from all four legs of each animal. And I'll talk about these data here in a second, but we had dry lots in 2 of the years and went out to pasture actually in the last year. I'm sorry? Okay, I'm done?
No, go ahead.
So these are the treatment groups. They had a control, which was the mineral oil carrier, the repellent, which is geraniol, which in the mineral oil carrier, the insecticide was permethrin in this case, and what Gary's calling the push-pull strategy, which is similar to what I was talking about earlier, in concept anyway, to, in some respects, the rangeland management system, which is treat half the cattle with repellent, so push the flies off the cattle, and leave half the cattle untreated. And they did this through running cattle through chutes. And so this is what they found. So in 2013, we had a very drought-stricken year, so we could not put the cattle out to pasture. So it was done in a dry lot, so these numbers are pretty high. So the stable flies here on the y-axis and across the x weeks of sampling. And you can see both in the repellent treatment and in the control, and in the push-pull treatment, we had a significant reduction in stable fly due to the those two methodologies. It was dry lot again in 2014. Again, really high numbers of flies. The most conspicuous, treatment pairs really stood out, other than all the treatments had significant reduction of flies compared to the control over a few of those sample weeks. And then in 2015, sort of the same case. The cattle went back out to pasture, so you can see the numbers went down accordingly, and we saw a reduction in fly numbers due to all the either the insecticide repellent or the push-pull strategy. And here's the data, just looking at it, it's a week total. So in conclusion, repellent affects flies at least for 1 week period. The repellent and the push-pull treatments were equivalent to an insecticide treatment at least. And there's probably a need for more methodologies developed for these treatment strategies. So just wrapping this up then, trying to tie these two things together. We're in pursuit of these.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, sorry.